Hello?
Hey, what's up?
Oh, you know, the huge.
Scraping by?
Scraping by. Hello.
Hello, welcome back.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
I can't even lie. We just fully recorded this entire episode and then realized that the audio was shit. So now we're re-recording
it. Literally was like static TV sound over us talking.
It was like too bad to work with. Run it back.
Yeah. So, how was your week?
My week was okay, minus the fact that I'm sick now. Michael and Alex were sick like last week, and I was like, oh, I'm not gonna get it, like I'm good. And then I got sick like yesterday, and I was like,
I know, fuck. I was like damn, your immune system is built different.
Evidently not. She was just,
well, you lasted a while. Waiting.
Yeah, that's true. So it's not that bad though, like I don't have a fever, which is nice. It's just like a sore throat and a little bit of a cough. What else? I had a menti bee on Tuesday when we were originally going to record, so that's why we're recording literally on Friday.
Yeah.
And then I worked the past 3 days, and at the event that I was at, Alex won't be surprised because I already told him this, but this lady had a little skunk, and it was really cute, and it was like a pet skunk.
That is so cute.
It was adorable. They're really soft. It was her name was Sable. She was really cute, and she was from a skunk rescue that, like, this, like, foundation, like, rescues them from, like, fur factories, basically, like, illegal fur factories. And nonetheless, I got a pet a skunk, and it was so sick.
I'm surprised they like allow that in the building.
It's technically a service animal.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
service, if they're skunk.
A service skunk. Dude, somebody brought a service peacock on a plane one time. You didn't hear that news story? That was like a whole thing.
No. Yeah. Wait, I definitely saw a video of that.
Yeah, somebody brought their service peacock on a plane. It's like, you know what?
Okay.
Slay, I guess. What did you do this week?
Not much. Crashed out.
Yeah. I love a good crash out.
Trying to figure out what to do. I was like thinking about going to grad school again, like just pondering that possibility, kind of like, because a lot of college I was like, god, I hate school, this sucks, and I was just like pushing through because it's what you gotta do when you're in it. And then, but now I'm like, I just like don't know what to do, and like I'm not finding psychology related jobs, and like it would open a lot of doorways if I got a degree, but it's like three more years of school, and I don't want to do that. So I don't really know. I'm kind of like just like crossing my fingers that like some opportunity is going to come up,
or like something manifests,
something's going to click, or like something's going to happen. I don't know though.
Yeah, that's what I had my menti bee about. I had my menti bee about not like knowing what the hell to do with my life, or like what direction I need to go in, or like if I should go to grad school or not, or like where I want to move. Literally had a menti bee about all the things that I cannot control, because I don't like not being in control.
Yes.
With like my life. So it's, yeah, I get the place that you're coming from, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm glad that you're feeling better.
Yeah, I'm feeling much better. So, Alexander, what are we going to talk about today?
Today, we just like needed to do something. And so I was looking. We needed a topic. So I was looking through my notes. I basically, like, after each term of school, I would, like, file away all my, like, I took notes by hand in college, and I would just, like, put them in a big binder.
That's then, iconic, like, honestly. Ordered good by, for
like,
you.
Each class has a little section, and then, like, each term, so it's, like, I have a big binder for each year of college that has all the notes in it.
That's so sick.
And I only looked through the most recent year or two. I looked through the junior year and my one term of senior year, but anyway. Compiled some interesting things I learned, and so I was just gonna share those as fun facts, which now you've already heard, but you're gonna hear them again.
Yay! It'll get really ingrained in my brain.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get started. My first fact is, if any of you guys watch like Criminal Minds or any of those like FBI like psychological profiler, like behavioral analysis, like whatever profiling sort of shows.
Guilty.
Which I used to watch Criminal Minds. Not real. Forensic profiling is a pseudoscience and is not backed by any data.
I literally hate that. One of my favorite shows is literally entirely on that. And it's Mindhunter on Netflix. If you haven't seen it, it's really good. But that really is so disappointing because I did not know that.
Yeah.
And it's such a good show. I thought it was real.
I know. I liked took a forensic psychology class because I was like, we're going to learn how to profile or whatever. And then...
Let me start profiling these hoes.
And then he was like, that's fake. And I was like, oh.
Okay. Oh. You just crushed
it's
my dreams.
Just based on like stereotypes and biases, and they did a test, and college students performed equally well as FBI profilers in creating a profile.
I bet the FBI someone. Fucking buried that study. They're like, no,
they were like, oh,
that's not real.
Yeah,
fake news.
And that happened with the DC snipers. They like incorrectly profiled that it was one shooter, and that they were like that it was a white man between like 30 or. 20s and 30s or something like that, and ended up being two black men. One was 17 and one was 40, and they ended up like stopping them at a traffic stop, and then be like, nah, they don't fit the profile, so they didn't like check the card. Okay, and then next we learned that this is called the criminogenic effect, that incarceration actually increases the odds of a subsequent criminal behavior.
The prison system not working?
Yeah, it doesn't work at
no.
all. Rewards and incentive-based systems work better than punishment systems. Maybe giving people therapy or like rehabilitation stuff instead of like putting them in a small concrete room.
Yeah, let's literally making them
to help them
practice labor
learn.
For 10 cents a day. Maybe yeah. that's not a good thing.
Yeah. So that doesn't work, which I feel like most people know the prison system is not effective.
God, I hope so. I hope most people know that.
But it makes people money, so they keep doing it.
Yeah. Capitalism demands your sacrifice, sweetheart. Don't you forget it.
Yes. Next we learned that data does not support any way of detecting lies, which like polygraphs are only 55% accurate.
I hate that. I hate that they still use it.
Yeah,
actually
it's
more.
Still admissible in court. But they mostly use it to like coerce someone into providing a confession.
I mean,
which
yeah, but then what
is bad, because false confessions are actually not that uncommon.
No, I that's the thing. I'm like, it's still bad, because what if it's a false confession? They just feel like pressure
yeah.
to do it, and they're like, well, like yeah, because people can be manipulated so easily, especially by the fucking police, and it's like that's
yeah.
still a bad thing. That's still bad.
Yeah, I remember we learned about like the four types of like false confession. I'm trying to remember what they all were, but like one of them was even like you just get gaslit so hard by the police.
You're like, I guess,
because they like stress you out. You're in this like room with like intense lighting, and like you're getting like pressured super hard, and everyone's like pissed at you,
hours.
And then you just like want to get out of that situation because it's so distressing, so you just literally confess, and it's like not even that uncommon.
That's insane.
Yeah,
that's so scary.
That happened. I think that's what happened with the Central Park Five. Was like,
yeah, no, they put them all in separate rooms underage,
yeah.
without parental
and
supervision.
All five of them falsely
yep.
confessed.
I watched I watched a show on Netflix about it, but no, it was like really sad because they like pressured them Again, it was a TV show, so it might have been dramatized, but, like, I think it was based on true events. Like, one of the cops, like, hit one of the children.
Wow.
And was like, you better fucking confess to this. And he, like, if they didn't know, because they were also, like, what's that? There's that, oh my god, I learned about it in political science, like, years ago, but I don't remember what it was. But it basically, if you, like, take a bunch of people, accuse them of a crime, and say, oh, well, this person said that you did it, and, like, or they, like, admitted that they did it and you did it, like, they're more likely to confess to something that they didn't do. If they separate them. Like, if
yeah.
you separate a group, basically.
Yeah.
But
yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, that's really fucked up and really foul.
Yeah.
Hey.
Then we learned that eyewitnesses are very compelling. This is all, like, forensic psychology related, so we'll get into more, like, regular psychology in a minute, but... in court, eyewitnesses are very compelling to juries, but they're the number one reason for wrongful convictions. Because it takes a long time usually to like get to a trial. It can take like years sometimes, and the longer the time from the incident, the witness becomes more confident in what they saw but less accurate, because every time that you recall a memory and it gets re-encoded, it becomes less accurate. And every time you like you tell a story, anytime you like bring a memory out, it comes out of your long-term memory, and then it has to go through like your schemas and things, and then goes back in, and then it's less accurate.
That's crazy,
because it gets altered a little bit.
That's so bad.
Yeah, so all those stories y'all are telling for like the 20th time, it's not that
not
accurate anymore. Probably
it's not accurate anymore.
It's shifting. Then okay, in my cognition class, this was like we learned about a bunch of things that like help you like study better. Taking tests actually helps you encode stuff much better.
Oh my gosh, I hate to hear that.
I love tests, honestly. I love a test.
What?
I would much... Okay, well, yeah. I actually... I enjoy a test. Randomly,
you're
I will
a crazy
say that.
Person.
And I would
You and no one else.
Much rather take a test over any other, anything like a presentation or a paper or anything like that.
Really? I would take a paper over a test. Absolutely 100%. Not. I stress myself out with tests so hard.
I love a test. Crazy. When I was looking at grad programs, I was looking at one and it said that instead of a thesis, you could just take an exam. And I was like, need to do that. Need to do that. But if you sleep or rest or do something where you aren't really activating your mind much after you study, it will go into your memory much better.
That makes sense. I feel like I've implemented that. I think my mom told me that actually when I was a kid, because she'd be like, yeah, read your... She'd also tell me to read like a chapter, I think it's like at least two times over, like out of a textbook, yeah. Because it helps you also synthesize the information better and then go to bed after you read it.
Yeah, like rehearsal is like really, yeah, just repeating something in your mind is how you encode it better too.
Yeah.
Or if you connect it to yourself in some way, that's helpful. Because that's more interesting to a human brain if it's related to you.
All narcissists.
Yeah. Or if you think about just, like, the more complex, like, if you connect it to things, it's, like, instead of, like, memorizing a word for the sound, like, if you memorize what it means and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Just, like, give it context and stuff, that's helpful. Which I feel like most people know. But study before you sleep.
Study before you sleep.
Okay. People could debate this, but... The DSM which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's on the 5th edition, I think, right now. It's for insurance purposes and selling medications.
Lovely.
Because the criteria, people are very varied.
Yes.
And people don't fit specific criteria that well a lot of the time. So they get diagnoses that aren't like necessarily that specific, or your symptoms show up differently, and it's sort of up to like the psychologist or psychiatrist to be like, this is kind of the vibe, or like to just like give you a diagnosis.
That's kind of scary too though, because you could go to one psychologist and another, and then they could give you two different things, and I guess that would makes sense why people are like people will experience like being on the wrong medication for like literally years.
Oh yeah,
because they're like misdiagnosed.
Yeah, and I think a lot of times, like, psychiatrists and stuff are, like, incentivized to, like, prescribe.
Get them back.
Yeah, I feel like psychiatrists kind of have a bad reputation for, like, just, like, selling medication or giving people medication to solve their problems instead of, like, something else that might be more beneficial. Yeah. Or a lot of times people don't get warned, too, that, like, even, like, a regular, like, SSRI antidepressant is, like, really difficult to get off of, like...
Oh, and they don't tell you that. They don't tell you that stuff ahead of time, yeah. Yeah. No, I literally, as somebody that got prescribed an SSRI and then decided not to go through with it, my doctor did not give me a warning that, like, it's incredibly difficult to get off of and you will likely experience withdrawals if you're trying to get off of it.
Yeah.
Did not explain that to me. I had to find that out for myself through a family friend that was on an SSRI for decades, got off of it, and like literally like had the worst withdrawals, and that like I've never seen this person like act like that before, like so fucking depressed, and I was like, oh my god,
yeah,
I literally dodged a fucking bullet, I guess, by not taking that SSRI, because like it's kind of like a you get stuck on it kind of thing.
Yeah,
that's so scary.
It also like fucks with everything. Like a lot of people don't know that like an SSRI or any sort of like neurotransmitter impacting drug, which is like all of them pretty much, yeah. But you have like serotonin, like norepinephrine, like dopamine, all those things are like not just in your brain, like those are throughout like your body. Mm-hmm. So it's going to affect you in like lots of other ways. There's like lots of side effects to all these things.
Yeah, that's the other thing they didn't tell me about, because that's why originally I stopped taking it, because I took one and had like the worst side effects. Like I had extreme anxiety. I also like my stomach, like I felt so fucking nauseous. My stomach hurt so bad like after I took it, and I was like, what the fuck? And then I talked to my mom, who's a nurse, and she's like, oh yeah, no, that's like the side effects they just don't tell you about. Because I remember I literally specifically asked my doctor, I'm like, hey, what are the common side effects? And she's like, oh,
was
like,
it a psychiatrist or a general practitioner?
I think it was a general practitioner, so okay. Maybe that's why she didn't tell me. Maybe. Must know that, because I feel like that's like now I'm like, it's common knowledge, like I apparently most people I know are like, oh yeah, no, it fucks with your stomach.
Yeah,
but I talked to my mom and she's like, yeah, no, like it totally fucks your stomach, and the doctor that prescribed it to me, the only side effect she said is like, oh, it might make it harder to fall asleep. She never mentioned anything else.
That's so fucked up.
Yeah, no, nothing. Never said that it was like really difficult to get off of. She even told me, she's like, oh, it's like a temporary solution, because I was having just like really bad anxiety and I was like, I need something to manage this. And she's like, okay, let's try Zoloft. And she's like, no. But you can get off of it.
You generally start experiencing the beneficial effects for like weeks from SSRIs.
Oh, wow, she really
that's why a lot of times they prescribe like something else, like Xanax or something in the meantime before the SSRI actually kicks in. Oh, I would kill
for a Xanax. No, not, but, no, yeah. She thought, I get, no, it was Zoloft. And, yeah, yeah. The issue I remember going to her, I was like, yeah, I have depression, like, occasional depression, but, like, the thing that's really getting to me right now is my anxiety. Mm-hmm. And she was like, Zoloft. She's like, it'll do both. Nice. And I was like, okay. And then it made me literally feel like I was gonna die. So I was like, okay, let me get off.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah. Medications are often, like, overprescribed and, like...
Oh,
they they are beneficial for a lot of people, and they are important, and they are necessary for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I think, like, when sometimes they're just prescribed when it's, like, someone could get to the root of the issue and, like, with therapy or some other method that would be, like, more effective.
Yeah, and we're not gonna sit here and, like, shit on SSRIs. Obviously, they're beneficial, but
yeah.
There needs to be a lot more transparency with regards to that. Because, yeah. I think a lot of people that start taking them, like, me personally, yeah, I have really bad anxiety, but, like, it's manageable. Like, I do things that help me manage it, or I just suffer sometimes, and it's okay. But, like, if I had known that SSRI was something that I probably would never be able to get off of, I would have literally never started taking it in the first place. Thank God, like, I wasn't on it for very long. I did stop taking it, and I was absolutely fine. But if I didn't know that, I would have been really angry, because that's not something I wanted to be on for the rest of my life.
No, yeah.
Anyhow.
It, like, it, like, alters the neurotransmitter receptors and stuff in your brain and stuff. So it's, like, they don't tell you the impacts that's going to have. But...
That's insane.
Okay, back to the DSM stuff. Also, yeah, like, a lot of times it's just, like, the DSM is describing a normal reaction to, like, a traumatic experience or something a lot of times.
That's...
Like, sometimes it's a disorder, like, adjustment disorder is, like... For, like, a few months. Like, it doesn't last longer than 6 months. And it's just, like, a few month period where you're, like, distressed and stuff because there's been, like, a big life change or something. Which is, like,
that's
temperamental. Really, like, different people have different levels of anxiety. And that's, like, a normal that, like, some people are going to be, like, shaken up or, like, distressed for a while when they, like, have a huge life change.
Yeah. That's
and like, they don't need to, like, get prescribed, like, a fucking...
A drug.
Xanax that they're... Or, like... SSRI that they're not gonna be able to get off of or something. It's just like, yeah. And some people find it helpful to get a diagnosis because they're like, this is validating, like, something is going on. Or, and some people are like, feel it's like shaming and like that there's like something wrong with them if they have a diagnosis. So it like goes different ways for different people.
Yeah, it kind of just depends on the case. I was gonna say, didn't the DSM also used to describe being homosexual as like,
yeah, there's still, and like transgender and stuff as like mental
illness. Is that still in there?
No, but gender dysphoria, I think, is in the DSM still as, like, a disorder to, Jesus. Like, have, like, to be, like, distressed that your gender identity doesn't match your gender assigned at birth. So, yeah.
I was going to say, I don't know, the history of the DSM does not, it's not giving.
And it's complex because having it in there does allow people to, like, get treatment that's covered by insurance if they're experiencing gender dysphoria.
That's true.
And at the same time, it's, like, kind of stigmatizing something that is a normal experience for a lot of people.
Yeah.
So, I also found it interesting that a lot of times disorders show up differently in different cultures. One of the ones I was thinking of was that schizophrenia is like it's more commonly paranoid schizophrenia in like Western countries and like the US and stuff. And in other places, I think specifically we learned about India, but I think a lot of Eastern countries that it's like, catatonic schizophrenia is the most common presentation of schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm. That is super interesting.
Yeah. And then we learned about a bunch of like culture bound syndromes, which are just like specific to different cultures. But one called hikikomori is specific to Japan, and it's a social withdrawal condition where someone will like shut themselves into like a room for like months, you know, and like not go to work or school or whatever, and just like completely isolate themselves. And that isn't like something that is recognized in other places.
No,
and
yeah.
It's not, or at least it's not common.
No, yeah, because like that's crazy that, because we now have, because what we were talking about, I'm not going to pretend like this is a profound new thought. We already talked about this. But we did talk about like the thing, bed rotting in the United States. Like that's, or I think I've only ever seen in the context of the United States, obviously. But that's like now, and like, I want to make the clarification. We're not talking about the cute aesthetic bed rotting. We're talking about, like, the bed rotting where, like, you literally can't leave your bed for weeks on end. And, like, it's, like, a really severe depressive episode.
Yeah.
But I was, like, it, in a sense, that's kind of similar. But also, this whole term bed rotting is, like, very new. Like, at least to put a term to it.
Yeah, and I remember learning that it's more social anxiety related than depression related.
Which one?
This Hikikomori.
That one's more social.
I think that the one that you're talking about is probably more depression.
Yes, but I think so.
Yeah. Okay, there's just a few more. One thing that is that IQ has increased over the over generations, which is called the Flynn effect. But IQ is stable across lifespan. So, like, and they can't really explain, like, why necessarily it's increased over time.
I didn't know that it was something that was kind of, like, predetermined. Like, or not predetermined, but, like, developed at, like, a very, very young age. And then that, you know, it remains the same.
Yeah.
Which is super interesting.
Yeah, like, they can do theoretically, they can do an IQ test on a kid and it should be the same as an adult. It would be a different test. And because it's scored against your peers, from what I understand.
Oh, okay.
So it's, like, the four-year-old, the percentile that they get would be related to other, like, four-year-olds. If a four-year-old were to take an IQ test, and then that's the percentile they would get. And theoretically, it should be the same when they're an adult.
Got you.
That's okay, my understanding, at least. That makes sense. But, yeah. So they don't really know why that happens, but maybe because there's more, like, toys and simulation for kids that help, or, like, early learning,
Yeah, there's more of an emphasis on early learning, definitely, at least within the last, like, 100 years. Like, now it's a lot, people do generally understand, like, it's pretty important to, like, stimulate your child because, or, like, read to them or have them toys that, you know, stimulate, like, their brain because it's seen as beneficial.
Yeah, you're not supposed to, like, give your kids, like, a type of toy where you just, like, press a button and it makes a noise. It should be, like, something they have to, like, think about or, like, do, like, take some sort of effort.
iPad parents would hate to hear that.
They would The iPad is just, like, a pacifier for a child, and I feel like sometimes I'm like, I would never do that, but then it's like, I don't have kids, I don't know, I might be like,
yeah, I know,
I need a fucking break, give those kids an iPad.
Get your iPad, your sticky disgusting iPad. Have you ever, do you ever see those, like, iPads? Oh my
god, that, like, gross. Yeah, colorful chunky case on it.
Yeah, and then you're just like, oh, I know that thing is sticky. Yeah, everywhere. There's not a single part of that iPad that's not sticky.
Yep. That's making me think about, though, like, psychology is, like, so not concrete, kind of, because you can't, like, observe what's happening in someone's mind directly, and so it's all, like, LOL, like, it's vibes. Just, like, a guess. Yeah, it's just vibes. Like, they can do studies and stuff, but it's all, like, theories. Like, there's nothing that's, like, that necessarily, I mean, yeah, generally it's, like, nothing that concrete, and it could be replaced by a newer theory when we learn more, and there's a lot of unknown, so... Kind of interesting, kind of fun to be we don't really know.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm just kind of, we're just playing with these theories and we're guessing.
Yeah. But. About 3% of Americans have antisocial personality disorder, which means that they're either a psychopath or a sociopath.
That's way more than it should be.
Yeah.
I know a sociopath.
I think I know who you're talking about.
You do. And I really dislike him.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Name drop. No, I'm just kidding.
Most people with antisocial personality disorder are men.
Shocker.
Yeah. Okay, this is the last one of these facts, but this one is interesting. About 30% of kids experience a major mental disorder or developmental issue in their childhood.
That is way...
That's like almost a
way
third.
Too high.
Us.
That's us. I fear we're part of that statistic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I texted my mom because we got basically to this part and then realized that our recording was awful. I texted my mom and asked her, but she hasn't answered yet, about what age, like... Doctors were like, she might have anxiety.
Yeah.
But you were 4.
Yeah, apparently. I was, like, looking at my medical records, and it was, like, anxiety. And I was like, oh, what year was this? And it was, like, 2006 or something. Oh! And I was like, what?
Oh,
I was, like, 4 years old.
Y'all but, clocked me.
No, literally. But I didn't go to... I know, like... And then I was looking through the doctor's notes later, and when I was, like, 10 or something, I, like, was, like, afraid to, like, eat anything because I was, like, thought I was gonna choke, and I, like, or, like, not anything, but some different foods, and I, like, wouldn't eat if I was, like, alone because I thought I was gonna choke and die and whatever, and I had to go to some, like, swallowing specialist to, like, do an x-ray thing to, like, look at it, and then they were, like, he should see someone, like, a psychologist.
He's seeing a psychologist.
But I never knew that. I was never told that I was supposed to see a psychologist. Damn. And then I got sent to one when I was, like, 12 for, like, one session, and I was, like, fuck this.
You're like, never again.
But then I went back in high school, and I've been there ever since.
Period. Full circle.
Twice a week.
Now we're at twice a week.
Yeah.
Yeah, I started going to a therapist. I think I was really young. I must have been, like, 6, maybe 7. Maybe I was 7. That makes sense. Yeah, that's when I first started seeing a therapist, and then it was, like, on and off from that period of time until, like, I don't remember the last time I saw a therapist. That doesn't mean that I don't still need one. I definitely do. That's a future investment.
Yeah, honestly, bless my parents for paying for my therapy. I'm literally eternally indebted.
Y'all are saving me, for real.
For real. But yeah, I mean, I guess it makes sense, too, that a lot of kids, because it's, like, really jarring to, like, grow up and then see and come to understand, like, the world and, like, how difficult so many things are and, like, all the stuff that's going on, and especially, like, now when you have more access to like, understand and, like, visually see, like, on social media or whatever, like, horrific things.
I know, I'm scared for this new generation. They're gonna see some shit that, thank God, we were the last, like, age range to, like, not see that stuff, and then after that, everyone's screwed. They're, like, gonna see horrendous, because, like, we saw horrendous stuff on, like, social media, but we were, like, you know, early teenagers, which is better than, you know, being 8 and watching some horrific stuff.
True.
But
maybe that's why, like, our generation and the ones below us are so fucking funny on social media, is because that's how people are, like, doing it.
Yeah.
Like, they have to laugh.
Like, you have to laugh because of the horrors that you've been exposed to from a young age. Like, what's a horrible... Oh, my God. Did you ever watch Two Girls, One Cup?
No.
Somebody showed it to me, and I was mortified in middle school.
Yeah.
Mortified.
I remember, like, when that was, like, coming out, and I was, like, hearing about it, and I was, like, I didn't watch it, but...
I don't need to see that. No, I didn't want to see it. Somebody, like, against my will showed it to me. What else? Oh, Human Centipede.
I remember, like,
middle school showed me that.
Watching the trailer, but I didn't want... Did you watch the movie?
Yes.
Ew.
But I stopped. Like, after a certain point, I felt so sick. I was like, you need to turn this off. Or, like, I'm going to call my mom to pick
me
up.
No. Oh, my God. Even the trailer, I was like, this is so remarkably disturbing.
So disturbing. I never told my mom that. Like, somebody, it was, like, in middle school that somebody, like, to a sleepover and we watched, she was like, we got it off, like, 1, 2, 3 movies. By the way, it was not my suggestion.
Like,
cause
pirating it.
Literally, I didn't know what it was. Mm-hmm. And my friend was like, no hate. You know, I have not talked to her in years, but she's cool. But she was like, we should watch Human Centipede. And I was like, no. I don't know what that is. Okay. And then we started watching it, and it just, I was like, oh, I'm like 12. And I'm like, I don't need to be seeing this.
No.
I really don't.
Oh my God.
I think those are the only two really disturbing things that stuck out to me, though. Anyways, mom, I'll never tell you what friend that was, but just know I just still turned out okay. And don't look up the Human Centipede. You don't need to know what it is.
Yeah, I can't even believe that, like, got made into a movie, or that's a movie.
Yeah,
I remember watching the trailer and being like, who the hell wrote this?
No, what sick person wrote it? Who, like, wanted to be in it? And then who funded it? Like, literally anybody that had any, like, inch to do with this project, what the fuck were you thinking? I'd love to
I mean, they're getting their money because people like to watch, like, really fucked up stuff.
Yeah, but that one was, like, I will never revisit that movie in my entire fucking life. That movie's fucking disturbing. And there's also there's, like, two other ones, by the way. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And the Human Centipedes get longer and longer with the movies. I'm not kidding.
Oh, my God.
I'm not kidding. You can Google it.
I'm absolutely not Googling that.
Don't Google it.
The most disturbing movie I've ever seen is Hereditary.
Oh, babe. Good for you.
I know.
I can't.
That's got to be, like...
It's up there.
Oh, okay. I guess... What's that one called? Like, Antichrist or something?
Oh, yeah. Honestly, I will say, I kind of forgot that. I, like, blocked Human Centipede out of my mind. Thank God. But, yeah, that one movie, Human Centipede is definitely worse than Antichrist. But Antichrist was also just, like, really gross and disturbing. I don't know.
I
got bored during COVID, and I was like, I, like, went on TikTok, and I was like, what's a disturbing, scary movie? And then I watched that one, and I was like, I didn't need to see that. That was not meant for my eyes.
Since I watched Hereditary, I have not watched a horror movie since, and that was, like, 2 years ago.
Damn,
and
that was the not. One. That was
I was
the
like,
one.
I was like, you know what?
I don't need to.
Because for a while, I've been like, I don't really love horror movies that much. Like, they kind of, like, give me nightmares. And then I watched that one, and I was like, yeah, that's kind of the last straw for me.
That was the one. That set me over the edge.
I'm not watching another horror movie.
Yeah, honestly.
Ugh, That movie left me like fucking hollow.
No, that
it literally makes you feel like nauseous and like, ugh.
Yeah, that movie was really disturbing. Actually, I will admit that too, because the first time I watched it, I like was supposed to sleep on my friend's couch, and then I finished the movie. She went to bed, and I was like, I went in her room. I was like, girl, I'm not sleeping alone tonight. I'm like, yeah. Scoot over right yeah. now. We're sleeping with the lights on.
Okay, moving on. Okay, now I'm done with like those fun facts. Then I was reading this book recently about something called IFS therapy, which stands for internal family systems. It's just like this type of therapy. I'm trying to think of how into this I want to go. I guess it's basically, it just like this, it's a way of viewing like the psyche as multiple, like you are made up, your psyche is made up of parts,
mm-hmm.
is what, how they describe it. Which, there's like exiled parts, which are like parts that are, you've had difficult experience, and then a part of you took on that really difficult experience because it would be too much for you to function if that was like your normal experience, was like experiencing the fear of like something horrible or whatever. Yeah. So it gets taken on by a part of you, and then other like protective parts form around it, like anxiety, maybe like, oh, I'm going to be anxious, I'm going to avoid any sort of situation that might like trigger this exiled part because I don't want to bring up that fear ever again, or like I don't want anything to bring up this anger or this shame or whatever the experiences are.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, so it's just like viewing yourself like as parts, and I have found it really interesting. I've read a few books about it. It's been helpful for me to think about things in that way. And anyway, okay, so here's an interesting thing that I learned in that book, which is the more inhibition that someone has, like the more like restricted they are about different things, or like holding themselves in, sort of, the more like disinhibition there is to counterbalance it. So the more they're like rebel in other places.
Oh.
So it was describing like this as a way to understand why like sometimes like priests and like the Catholic Church, who are like celibate and like super strict and like don't let themselves like do stuff, like fling way in the opposite direction, and then there's been like so much like molestation and like things like that.
Oh my god. Because I was literally, I just watched Spotlight over again, which is a movie kind of about like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was literally thinking about that. I was like, why is it the Catholic priests? Why? Like, obviously there's pedophiles everywhere, but like, why is it so many Catholic priests? I never even thought about it in that way.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Or like another example that it gave was like someone who like overworks at their job or spends all their time working and like doesn't let themselves relax might like counterbalance that by like binge drinking, or like people that are in school are like studying super hard all week and then they need to like go like get blacked out on the weekend.
Yeah, literally. Things like blacked that. Out every single weekend. Holy shit, that makes so much sense.
Yeah, so that was like, oh wow, that like makes so much sense. That's so interesting. I'm just going to talk about one more thing about IFS, because I feel like it's going to be difficult to explain these without like explaining the IFS like model more like in a more detailed way. But when we're doing something like reactively, or we're doing something that feels like compulsive, or something like drinking, or like using, like I need to use drugs, or like having sex a bunch, or like binge eating, over exercising, compulsively like scrolling on your phone, anything like that that is like you're really drawn to, like, and it's like in like sort of a reactive way, that's like described as a protective part of you, like a reactive protective part of you. And then like the goal would be that like the to actually like get to the part of you that's behind that, like what is that reactive protective part protecting, like why am I binge drinking, why am I binge eating, why am I taking this drug, or like doing this a bunch, scrolling on my phone because I'm distracting myself or protecting myself from something underneath it. And if you can help like the difficult emotion that's underneath it, then the urge to do this other thing will disappear. Does that make sense?
Oh my god, no, that's literally making me think about something that I experienced in like a completely different way, actually. Because okay, I like when I was a kid, I think I already told you this, maybe I did, I don't know, and now we're exposing it on the pod. When I was when I was like, I think I was like 12 when I first developed like an eating disorder. Mm-hmm. I think I've told you about that before, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember when I developed it, like I didn't really know why, because like y'all can't see me. I've been like when I was a child, I was a very like skinny, lanky kid. Like I've always been like very thin, like, And I remember when I first developed, like, the eating disorder, like, it wasn't because I wanted to be thinner, necessarily. Like, I already knew intrinsically that I was thin, but mm-hmm. I still had it. And I'm like, and that made me realize, like, during that period of time in my life, I remember feeling, like, a complete loss of control in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And it was probably literally a reaction to that, because anytime I've also had a relapse with the eating disorder, like, I haven't, like, had, like, a full, or I had a full-blown relapse, like, once when I was, like, in my later teens. It was the same thing, because I, like, felt a complete lack of control in my life.
Yeah.
So that was, like, the reaction that I, that was my, like, safety net, I guess, like, that I created in my brain to go back to. It's like, yeah. If I feel like I can't control that, then I can control this.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense, yeah.
Which is so,
yeah, food wow. restriction, I think, is a, like, a pretty, is talked about in IFS, too, as, like, a reactive protective mechanism.
No kidding.
Yeah, and I've, like, learned some about that. Like, a lot of times, like, eating disorder clinics are, like, not that effective, because they aren't really, like, going for the root of the issue. It's just, like, or it's just, like, you need to eat this at this time. It's, like, honestly, like, really not helpful. I think a lot of times it's, like, trying to make people eat, like, the certain amount at the certain time, and it's, like, not getting to the root of the issue at all. But
yeah, no, because definitely, yeah. I mean, yeah, some people do. I think, but I feel like I mean, actually, I'm going to speak out of my ass really fast, and I'm not going to state any facts because I don't know anything, but I definitely feel like there's definitely, of course, some people that do develop eating disorders for the desire to be thinner and, like, mm-hmm. appeal to a beauty, like, the established beauty standard, which, unfortunately, is thinness, mm-hmm. but a lot of people also, like, develop eating disorders because there's an underlying issue, and that's the coping mechanism, is, like...
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't even necessarily, because yeah, I feel like a decent amount of people, at least for me, myself, when I had an eating disorder, I was not concerned about what my body looked like. I already knew that I was thin, and like I already was adhering to the beauty standard. That wasn't it. I didn't want necessarily want to be thinner, but it was like, yeah, being able to, I guess, regain control, which is like such a weird manifestation of it, I guess, if you like think about it like that. It's like... But yeah, I think for a long time after, like in the wake of it, like when I actually did like recover, because I didn't even go to like a recovery thing. I like recovered by myself. I was like,
wow.
No, I literally was like, I got really fucking thin. I started having like pretty bad, like really, like it was bad. I don't even think I have pictures from that time period, and I fucking hope that none exist, because it was bad. But I remember like getting to a point where like, I was like extremely weak. I was tired all the time. And I was just like, if I had that like come to Jesus moment with myself. I was like, if I at like 14, I was like, if I keep doing this, like I'm going to fucking die.
Yeah.
So I need to get my shit together. Like this is not like good. And I just like recovered. I like took a, wow. It was like the summer before my freshman year, and I recovered to a degree. I was better than I like didn't reach like full recovery probably until like later in high school. And even still, like, I think I was actually ironically just talking about this with some of my coworkers, because most, I fear that most, probably people in general, but women specifically, go through a period of time of having distorted eating because mm-hmm. it's so normalized.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's, like, that's something that, like, literally never, it never leaves your brain, is, like, kind of how we were talking about it. Like, you always have those thoughts in the back of your head, because, like, once you develop that at such a young age, that's the coping mechanism you know you can rely on.
Yeah.
And you go back to it. Which is fucked, yeah. But that's such an interesting way to look at it instead, because, yeah, I definitely remember when I was, like, deep in the shits with it, I, like, didn't really understand why I was doing it. I just knew that I couldn't stop, which right. is
awful. Yeah. Yeah, that sounds like a reactive mechanism.
Oh, yeah. It totally, like, looking back, it totally fucking was.
Yeah.
It totally was.
Yeah, and some people's, like, restrictive eating is not reactive. It's, like, proactive. Like, they're, like, trying to, like, restrict their eating to lose weight, and it's yeah. not, like, reactive. In which case, a lot of times, like, we're talking about that's, like, a type of inhibition of, like, really strictly monitoring food, and then there will be the swing in the other direction where someone will, like, binge eat a bunch.
Yeah.
Or something like that. But in that, those are different things, because I guess eating restriction could be reactive or proactive.
And then the reactions could be, or like disinhibition could be different, like yeah. regards.
Yeah.
Huh. That's such an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah. I thought so too. It's like, yeah, it's super interesting. It's not like this type of therapy is, to my knowledge, isn't taught in like any universities. In order to be like certified in it, you have to go to a specific training program that is actually really hard to get into. It's like a raffle system because so many people want to do it.
No, wow, shit.
And I'm actually currently on a wait list.
Are you really?
To work, not to go to it, to work with an IFS therapist, I mean.
That would be sick.
Yeah.
That would be so cool. You would learn so much.
Yeah, I know.
I hope you get that. Manifesting it for you.
Yeah.
Yes. Everyone manifest for Alex that he gets in.
Well, no. I'm on the wait list to, like, work with a therapist that's trained in IFS.
Oh, what?
That's what I was saying.
Well, you would still learn so much. Sorry, that totally processed in my brain. I've been up since 4:30.
No, you're fine.
Well, also, everyone manifests for Alex that he gets off the wait list and can start that form of therapy.
I know. Because I feel like since I've, like, read all the books, or I've read, like, 3 books, not all the books, but...
every single book.
But I have watched, like, tons of YouTube videos about it. I've, like, spent a lot of time thinking about it. So it would be really cool to work with an IFS therapist.
No, I think that'd be really cool. Honestly, I'm like, damn, this sounds interesting. I kind of want to work with an IFS therapist. Maybe I'll get myself on a wait list. I'll do a different wait list, though, so I don't take away from your wait list. Because are you with a specific therapist?
On the wait list for one? Yeah.
Yeah, I'll do a different therapist. Also, we shouldn't have the same therapist. That'd be kind of funny, but we shouldn't do that. That's a bad idea.
Yeah. It'll be on Zoom because she is not here, but...
That makes sense. Because you said it's not a very common... It's not, like, super common yet.
It's definitely becoming more common, but it's just, like, hard to get the training because it's, like, a raffle to get into the training.
I'm surprised more, like, universities haven't implemented that
curriculum. Yeah, I don't think any have, to my knowledge.
Why?
Because
the things that you just said, that's the first... I took a psych class in college. This is the first, like... thing that's actually making sense to me. I'm like, makes sense.
All the time I'm reading the book, I'm literally like, sometimes I just like start laughing because I'm like, wow, like that makes so much sense and no one's ever explained it that way, and this is like, wow, this is amazing.
So why are we not implementing this more?
It's because there haven't been that many empirical like studies about it to like, and a university isn't going to adopt it if they don't have like a long history of the effectiveness through data.
So it's gonna be a minute. It's gonna be a minute. Okay.
Yes. That's what I think it's gonna be a while if it happens. But super interesting. Look into it if you want. I think the main book that I read is by the founder of it. His name is Richard Schwartz, and the book is called No Bad Parts.
Oh, period.
Which is also like super cool. Like that's one of the main like tenets is that like no part of you is bad, or every part of you has a good intention. Even if you're like doing something fucked up, the intention of that part of you is like good. Like can you think of anything right now that's like someone doing something fucked up?
Why did my mind go to killing somebody? Let's not use that example. That's a hard one to justify. Like binge drinking. That's like traditionally seen as like a bad thing.
Yeah, and that would generally, I think, binge drinking like would be seen usually as a reactive protective mechanism, which in IFS they would call it firefighter. It's just like the word they would use. So like comes in to put out the fire when something painful gets triggered inside you, and then you have the urge to go like get blacked out.
Yeah,
which even though and that is his intention, obviously can have harmful impacts because it's not like
of course
trying to protect anyone else. It's trying to keep you from feeling this pain.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like that's like a pretty like, I don't know, it's just like a nice way to think about like, oh, like there's not any part of anyone that's like inherently like
bad. Yeah, because that's like a really, especially like when you're like looking, I mean, I don't know if this is like, I'm assuming it's a universal experience, maybe it's just me, but like when you look inside yourself, like sometimes like, there's things that you don't like about yourself and you're like, oh, that's like the bad part of me, and that's like not a good way to look at it either, because no part of you is intrinsically bad unless, I guess, you're a serial killer. That might be bad.
Yeah, that gets into something, another portion sort of IFS that, where I was thinking about, I don't actually know, but I won't get into that.
Okay. I was like, you can get on your theory brain if you want.
Okay, well, I hope that you guys found some of that interesting. Hope you learned something.
Yeah, shit. I found that interesting, and I learned many things.
I'm glad.
I'm so happy. Thank you for educating me today.
I know, sometimes I think, like, God, I didn't learn anything in college, and then I, like,
and then you
like,
pull up that, you're like, wait, I do wait know things, it. I did learn things, yeah, you know, I didn't know any, like, basically any of this.
I guess that we'll talk to you guys next week.
Yeah, I guess we'll talk to you guys next week.
We hope that you have a beautiful weekend.
Yes. Happy early St. Patty's Day, if you celebrate.
Oh my God, when is that?
Monday.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Happy White Lotus. Oh my God, this episode is gonna get fucking nuts.
Yes, I'm so excited.
I saw a TikTok interview with one of the actors,
uh-huh.
and he was saying that he like it was Saxon.
Ew.
But he was saying that he's doing like a screening party with like his family and friends and stuff, and he was like, I'm gonna have to step out of the room for some of these scenes.
Oh fuck, there's gonna be some weird sex scenes.
So we know there's gonna be some weird shit either in this one or the next one probably, but I think it's gonna be on, because the next one is gonna be the party on the
be some weird shit going on that one.
Hopefully you guys are watching it too if you want, and if you're of age to be seeing that sort of thing.
And by the way, if you're underage, please don't listen to this podcast. It's not for you.
Wait, no, yeah,
go watch Cocomelon or something. okay
well, we'll see you guys later. Yeah. Or we'll talk to you guys later. Probably never see you.
Never see you. See you never. And with that,
may you scrape by with ease.